Hi, and welcome to the Planet Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Roanhouse, and my guest today is the first and original web drifter, Martin Sargent. How are you doing today, Martin?
I'm doing great, Patrick. Thanks for having me on your program.
So how's the weather in lovely San Francisco today?
Dude, it's brutal. It's brutal. It's like 83 degrees, which doesn't sound, I know you're in Baltimore, which is like a really cold day, especially in the summer of Baltimore. I think Baltimore is like one of the sweatiest cities in the world. Yeah. I understand right like that.
100% humidity during the summer.
Yeah. Well, for San Francisco, 83 degrees is blazing. So I'm just not used to it. So I'm glad we're not doing a video podcast right now because I'm streaming sweat.
So you kind of look like Mayor Joe Quimby from the one episode where he tries to get reelected.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that without the accent. Yes.
Yes. So, as if any of my fans don't know who you are, you originally started on Tech TV's The Screensavers, and then got your own talk show for late at night on Tech TV called Unscrewed with Martin Sargent. You've then worked your way through becoming a podcaster with such properties as The Web Drifter and also Martin Sargent's Internet Superstar.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit more about yourself. What are some facts that people don't know about? Like, where were you born? Where were you raised? Were you coming from another planet and you were sent here by your father to protect you from, the end of your original world?
All of those things are true, but I'd appreciate it if you did not bring up my father. No, he's a wonderful man. I grew up in Spencerport, New York. Spencerport, New York is a tiny little village on the Erie Canal. It's a wonderful little place. And, it's right near Rochester, New York, so sort of your neck of the woods. And
except 5 hours away.
Yeah, but I mean much closer than where I am out here in Old Fogtown. But I did a couple plays and stuff in high school, and I was always kind of doing like performing in front of my friends and stuff like that. But never did I think that, you know, it would be possible for a kid from Spencerport, New York to actually, like, you know, head out to Hollywood, head out and make it in the entertainment industry. And now in retrospect, I'm not sure that I have made it in the entertainment industry, because as I talk to you right now, I'm like brutally unemployed. But I did have a pretty good run for a while there. I never intended to get into it. I thought I was going to go into academia. I wanted to be a professor. I studied way too hard in college. And I was really fascinated by my subject matter. I studied 19th century American intellectual, cultural, and religious history, with an emphasis on literature. And I totally figured I would go on and get a PhD and just spend the rest of my life, you know, teaching in some university. But after I graduated from Cornell, I just wanted to take a little break before going to get the PhD. So, you know, I jumped in a car with some friends, and I traded my tweed for weed, and, you know, we just started driving west, you know, manifest destiny, go west, young man, and somehow we made it out to San Francisco, and, you know, it was the height of the dot-com boom, 1997, impossible to find a place here. It was the new gold rush. Everyone was coming out here to try to make their fortune, and all I wanted to do was work for some sort of a cool magazine like Mother Jones or something like that. Well, none of those things were hiring, so I ended up working for a computer magazine called PC Computing, and it turned out to be like the most fortunate thing. Even though I had never used really a computer before I started that job, that magazine was owned by a company called Ziff Davis, which then started up a TV station called ZDTV, which was 24 hours about computers and the internet. They needed to fill those 24 hours. So what they would do is tap their writers and editors from the various magazine holdings and have them on the show. And that's how I started appearing on Leo Laporte's shows, Call for Help and The Screensavers, just as a guest at first, as a pundit. And they liked what I was doing, so they eventually offered me a full-time contract. And that was how I started on television.
Now, you've gained quite a following, a cult following, as you will, just because of your rather macabre and strange rantings that you'll sometimes go into. What's your view on the kind of followingship that you've gotten? It's definitely, I would definitely say you have a cult status following. I know so many people growing up while in high school and who would just like watch Unscrewed and be like ass shits and giggles, you know, just laughing their heads off. What's your view on that? That kind of like fan following you had.
It definitely is a cult following, and there's a couple things about having a cult following. First of all, a cult following is the best kind of following that you can have in terms of allegiance, because they'll keep coming back. They really like you. They're very devoted, and no matter what project you migrate to, they'll follow you to that. You know, kind of like Trekkies do. The problem with a cult following is, you know, most cult followings are very small. They're very niche. So my appeal, I don't think, ever got very broad. So, you know, even though I had a lot of really great, very devoted fans, it never, what I was doing never really seemed to appeal to the mainstream. So in some ways it's really good because you get those really great fans who will follow you everywhere. But in some ways it's bad because, you know, when you work in the entertainment industry, when you work in television, it's all about, you know, catering to the lowest common denominator. It's all about, you know, what's going to play in Dubuque. And if your stuff doesn't have an appeal to the widest possible audience, the networks who are paying you aren't going to make any money off of you. And you're going to have a little bit more difficulty landing your next gig. I don't think I've ever done a show that was profitable. I've won a lot of awards for it. I've been reviewed very highly. Television critics seem to like what I do, but television executives, when they look at some of the ratings of some of my past shows, they're like, "Well, it's pretty good, but you know, you're not Ryan Seacrest." And you know, I'm glad I'm not Ryan Seacrest, and other ways I wish I had his money. Not to take anything away from Ryan Seacrest, I think he's one of the hardest workers in Hollywood.
Now, one of your more popular shows that has been lauded for its really just funny content was the celebration of viral characters on the show The Web Drifter.
Yeah.
What's the word on that? Like, I've heard some rumors that people are looking to probably pick it up either on the Travel Channel, and I heard one rumor that maybe Adult Swim might want to pick it up. Like, what's the news with that?
I haven't heard the Adult Swim rumor. We have pitched that show. We have had conversations about that show with the Travel Channel. We've sent that show out to a bunch of people. Originally, that show was commissioned by Comedy Central, actually, and we did the pilot for them, and the pilot episode, if you're familiar with it was actually the first three episodes. It was Alex Chu, the guy who invented the rings that give you eternal life. It was Dr. Fred Bell, the guy who is an alien contactee and has a dimensional rift that opens up in his living room when he lights a bunch of lasers and does a bunch of drugs and puts off a bunch of smoke machines, and these aliens come through it, and he's the super genius who invents all this amazing stuff. And then Eric White, who's the guy who lives in Amish country and couldn't get laid, so he invented a machine that he could bang. So I thought that those were three pretty solid episodes, and you know, that show, you know, those are three of our strongest episodes. People really liked it, but again, you know, Comedy Central, you know, it might not have that broad appeal. I think it was a mistake on their part. I think that Web Drifter is the best show I've ever done. It's the one that I'm most proud of, and I hope that it does get picked up by somebody else. Officially, it has not been canceled by Revision 3. If you go to Revision 3, which is the company that I produced 25 episodes of it for, you'll still see it on their lineup. And they do talk about doing another season. They would love to do another season. The problem with Web Drifter is, unlike a lot of shows that air on web television, it's very expensive to produce because it requires a great deal of travel. It requires, you know, my fee. It requires my writing and producing partner, Jay Speeden. It requires a camera person to go along with us. And we travel all over the country. And it's just expensive to do. and there's a lot of editing involved, so on and so forth. So it's a tough time right now to make money off of web television unless you get a sponsor attached right out of the gate. They're trying to do that. They're trying to sell the show. I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen. At this point, it would probably be better for us to tell Revision 3 that we'd like them just to give us the rights back and take it out into the marketplace and see if we can sell it to another buyer.
Going back from talking about what happened recently in the recent past, you're currently doing a new show, correct?
Yes, I am.
And what is that show?
I'm doing a show called This Week in Fun. I do that show with Sarah Lane, who people who are familiar with Tech TV and G4 and Revision 3 would be familiar with. And we do that show out of the production studio of a guy named Leo Laporte, who's a really pretty popular technology broadcaster.
I've never heard of him.
Well, a lot of people probably haven't. I mean, you know, certainly a lot of people have. But he does this network called Twit.tv, and there's about, I don't know, 10, 15 shows on there. And ours was officially added to the lineup of shows about 3 episodes ago. We've done 14 episodes. It's really starting to pick up a head of steam. Last time I looked, it was like number 20 on the iTunes podcast chart. Which doesn't mean that it's the 20th most popular podcast on the internet. It's the way the metrics for how iTunes computes those things is a little weird. It's how many people sign up in a finite period of time. But the point is it's growing. It's doing really well. People really seem to like it. So we hope that we're going to be able to seriously monetize that show in the not too distant future. Right now, we don't have any advertising. Right now, we actually lose money on that show because we have to drive an hour north to go to Leo's studio up in Petaluma. So there's the gas money and also the $6 bridge toll coming back over the Golden Gate Bridge. But we think that given the interest that people have shown in it, that we're going to turn that around real quick. So, yeah, we're really pleased with the reaction that it's got by the fans.
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of it as well. When you guys actually... I found it a little difficult at first to get onto it the first couple episodes because you didn't actually have it in a podcast at the time. So, like, one of the things I would do was I had a wireless router in my car and hooked up my phone to the wireless router. Like, it was the portable cradle point. And then mm-hmm. hook that up to then connect to the internet through that on my iPod Touch to then get it on the little Twit app.
Nice. Yeah, for the first 10, 11, 12 episodes, the only way that you could really watch it was when we were doing it live. And it's only been in the last 3 episodes or so that it's now archived and just the MP3 version, not the video version. If you watch it live on Fridays at 3 p.m., you can actually watch it. But if you just download the MP3, subscribe to it on iTunes, which I hope everyone does, then you can just listen to it. But what that does is it allows to broaden the audience a lot because, you know, 3 p.m. on Fridays, a lot of people aren't sitting in front of their computer watching, you know, my stupid show. They'd rather be out doing something. So it's really good that we're moving in that direction.
Now, to go back in time a little bit, I'm going to go back to March 25th, 2004. The day that will live in infamy of fans of Tech TV, Comcast decided to purchase Tech TV and merge it with their little channel called G4. Eventually, that led to a schism in the programming, which eventually killed Tech TV entirely and let you and many other of the members of the crew go. What were your initial feelings at that time, like, of, you know, when you first heard about the G4 Tech TV merger and how they wanted you guys to move from San Francisco to LA and all that stuff like that?
Well, initially, I was thrilled. I mean, I was upset that a lot of my friends and colleagues were being let go, but I was thrilled that my show and only 2 other ones on Tech TV were being brought on to be on G4. So it to us, to me and my staff, it was the best possible thing that could have happened to us because, you know, we were up here in San Francisco where Tech TV was produced, And we knew that if we were really going to, you know, make it big in the entertainment business, eventually we were going to have to relocate down to Los Angeles where everything is happening anyway. So this was a great opportunity to do that because they were going to pay for it. And, you know, they, you know, gave us nice moving expenses and all that kind of stuff. They built us a beautiful set. Everything initially seemed like it was the best possible thing that could happen to us. It wasn't until we actually got down there and started working at G4 that things went really badly. It turned out to be a really impossible place to work. The show was essentially produced by the lawyers, not by us. They handcuffed us and everything that we wanted to do, whereas up here at Tech TV, they gave us like pretty much free creative control over everything. They tried to tell us what kind of content we could do. I mean, they wanted to do their idea was to do a 24-hour station all about video gaming. My show was not about video gaming. It was a late-night comedy talk show about the darker, sexier, funnier side of the internet. So they wanted us to keep, like, you know, working in all these video game angles, which, you know, worked to a certain degree. But it was just really, really difficult. The morale of the staff went down really quickly, and eventually the people down there they just canceled the show very soon after we moved down there. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily for lack of ratings. It was just, you know, we just didn't seem to fit the model that they were doing.
It's like you were outside of the mold.
Exactly.
Now, being that you were the web drifter and were the person to go around and hunt around for very interesting things on the internet, what are some of the current places you go to right now for the internet, either it be for laughter or to completely disturb your own mind?
It's all sort of changed. It's funny, you know, back in the day, the sort of the weird sites, the weird stuff that you would find on the internet were all websites, because it was before video really existed. Or, I mean, even when I started Unscrewed, video was very much in its formative stages on the internet. So, you know, all the content that we would get would come off of like static web pages. Nowadays, it's interesting because it seems to be more and more rare that you find these really, really weird web pages, and everything is rendered in the form of a video. Having said that, you know, the places that you look for those sites and that content hasn't really changed. Although, you know, it does make it a lot easier in some regards. Like, you know, there's certain people that you can follow on Twitter who just have a fantastic knack, kind of like I do, for digging really deep in the internet, spelunking the darkest caverns of internet. And, you know, you follow the right people and they're going to lead you to all this stuff. You know, people are constantly emailing me great stuff. People are IMing me great stuff. So a lot of the work, you know, once people know what you're into, is sort of done for you. It's sort of like, you know, crowdsourced. But, you know, there's still certain sites that, you know, I'll look at every day, every other day to, you know, try to see what they found out there as well.
Do you think you've reached your level of being shocked? Like, have you lost all sense of, yeah, I've seen enough Two Girls, One Cup, or, you know, Goatsy to be like, yeah, I've seen that. Needs more pooper.
Yeah, you get really desensitized. You do really get desensitized after you've been doing this for a long time. But absolutely, there's still things that just shock you, disgust you, make you shut off your computer. And that's a really hard thing to make me do, is shut off my computer. But, like, there's just humanity never ceases to amaze me at how dark and disgusting they can get, and how they want to show that stuff off for potentially the entire world to see on the internet.
What was the last thing that made you shut off your computer that you can think of?
You know, I don't even want to talk about it. It was so disgusting. I can't even talk about it.
It's a what's in the box moment. What's in the box?
Yeah, it was just, it was one of those things where, you know, you see the link and you click on it and you really don't know what it is. And then you watch it and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I just watched that. I'll never forget that. I don't, it's just like sort of a life altering, awful moment. It was so gross. It was so gross and disgusting. And I'm not even, it's not even funny. And I'm not even going to bring it up on your show.
To go back to the websites real quick, can you name three that you go to today that are the ones that you're like, these are my great websites I go to?
I love, it's tough to say three. A couple of the old standards I like are GorillaMask.net. I like Afrojax. I like Unknown Highway. Those are three good ones.
Now you can keep going on more if you want to.
No. I don't want to give away all my
it's like, darn!
All my sources.
Okay. Now, one funny thing that happened recently with the downturn of the economy. Not that it was funny for you, but the funny ramifications of what happened were a lot of people were let go from Revision 3. One phrase that was coined out of that let go would be referring to CEO of Revision 3, Jim Lauterbach. The phrase is, eat a dick, Lauterbach. Did you come up with that? And you coined the phrase, the eat the dick, Lauterbach. Now, was that out of jest or was that like out of you like going like, God darn it?
Yeah. Originally, it was totally out of jest because the original context of that was when he had wanted to cancel this other show I did called Infected, and sort of spin it off in a new show. It was called Internet Superstar. And it was a lot of similarities to it, but it was also a different show. So the context was like we were driving around in my Cadillac outside the offices and I can't even really remember, and we started honking and Gator, my co-host at the time, holds up this sign, like it just says like it's this really shitty cheesy sign, it's like Internet Superstar, best show ever, and I start honking and then we drive off and Jim's like looking out the window and we're driving off, we go eat a dick, Lauterbach, like that. And so you know, Jim was totally in on the gag at the time, because you know, you stand at the window and he thought it was really funny. It was really funny. But you know, after the shows got canceled, like we got fired, it sort of became this little mantra around the internet directed at Lauterbach. They sort of took that phrase and kind of ran with it and used it in a way that we had not originally intended.
Now, a character to come out of your work, an interesting chap, as you will, was Joey the Intern. There's quite an interesting story to him. You mind telling my audience members who might not know what it is?
Well, Joey really did start out as an intern on Unscrewed, and we had several interns working on that show, but you know, Joey sort of had this look to him. He's had this like wild, unkempt hair, and you know, these sort of goofy glasses, and you know, he just looked like a little kid, like you know, kind of bad skin and everything like that. He's a genius, but you know, he's just like a typical computer nerd looking kind of guy. And we were sitting in a writer's meeting or a production meeting one time, and we wanted to do this bit called The Lighter Side of Linux, where it was like this big nerdy kind of guy like doing like a stand-up comedy show, and all of his jokes were really, really bad jokes about Linux and how Linux is so much better than Windows, and you know, it was kind of a silly bit. But like, we're sitting there and like, who's going to play the guy? And just then Joey walks into the room for like the first time. It was like his first day. And I'm like, he will be the guy. And he just pulled it off really, really well. And, you know, from that point on, we worked him into all kinds of bits, and he sort of became, you know, along with me and Laura Swisher, my co-host, and then Joey, sort of like the triumvirate of the three main people on the show Unscrewed.
He's the Max Weinberg to your Conan O'Brien.
A little bit. He was the butt of all the jokes, yeah.
From all of the interesting characters you've gotten to interview while doing all the different shows you've done, what's the one that just you wake up in the middle of the night with cold sweats and a panic going, oh dear God, not again?
I don't know if there's anyone that I wake up in a cold sweat and say, oh dear God, not again, because truth of the matter is, and this might be hard to believe when you watch shows like Web Drifter, any of my shows where we really interview like people way, way out on the fringe, really weird people, but all these people have sort of become my friends, you know? And I think we have a mutual, even though like you watch these things and like, my God, how do these people not realize that you're making fun of them? They never really saw it that way.
Someone was talking to them.
Yeah, they're just happy to get the exposure. You know, most of them have a pretty good sense of the humor about themselves. And, yeah, they just wanted the exposure. And so, you know, there's nobody that, like, you know, I did get a death threat one time from Dr. Bruce Goldberg, the time-traveling dentist. But so that was kind of spooky. But my favorite character that would keep coming back to and covering again and again and again has got to be Alex Chu. I think he's like the most fascinating character that I've ever come across. You know, if you start to peel the layers of the onion away on about why this guy has invented these crappy rings with magnets on them that he thinks will give him eternal life. And there's just so much to it. There's so many psychological angles to it. And it reaches into everything from, you know, his father who he thinks looks like Hitler, and his fascination with the Third Reich, and you know, his absolute fear of death, and you know, his belief that Asian people are not as good looking as white people. So he invented this pill that, you know, was supposedly make him white called the Gorgeous Pill. There's so many layers to this guy that you sort of miss if you just watch those couple things like the Web Drifter episode and everything. But, you know, I've spent so much time with this guy. In fact, a few years ago, we started to shoot a documentary about him. In fact, I'd love to, if I ever get off my ass, I gotta do it. We spent like 3 or 4 days with him to shoot this thing. It was called The Day in the Eternal Life of Alex Chu. And all of these things came out, and it was just wild, all the things. So I think he's the most complex, funniest, and most compelling character that I've ever come across in my career.
Yeah, definitely. I thought it was kind of interesting. Like, I remember when you had him interviewed, you were in the kitchen with him at his house, and you know, you definitely were able to pull things out of him. Like, I could see where he was like saying, you know, who wants to die? You know, you can't do anything. And just this kind of like downtrodden person who just, you know, was able to somehow get out of that by, you know, imagining or thinking that, you know, these items put him beyond what were his neuroses.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the thing about Alex is, a lot of people think, well, this guy's he's an a-hole. He's a huckster. He's taking advantage of people who are sick, people who have some sort of a terminal illness. And really desperate people would buy these rings saying, well, I've tried everything else. I'm going to buy these rings that will supposedly heal me, give me eternal life. Thing is, Alex really believes in these rings. He really, really believes in it. He's not trying to take advantage of people. He really wants sick people to use these things because he believes that it will heal them. And he's a really, really sweet guy. And yeah, he might be a little misguided, a little misinformed, but he's really trying to improve the universe.
I guess his personal soundtrack is Journey's "Don't Stop Believing."
I guess so. Either that or "Forever Young."
Well, I'd like to thank you for being the guest on the Planet Podcast today, and it was a real pleasure getting to meet you and talk to you through Skype today.
Hey, Patrick, pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for your interest.